FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. Today is April 5th, 2017. So we're in the midst of a bit of a war of cultures, of some say a civil war. I wouldn't quite go that far, but definitely a view of divergent opinions. And immigration, Trump seems to be at the forefront. As you know, we don't talk about politics much on the show, but every now and then we get an interesting guest on that I feel you really need to hear from, and person you're about to hear from definitely falls into that category. Her name is Tanisha Tingle Smith. She's founder and principal analyst of Global South Analytics, which basically analyzes emerging markets, political risk advisory consultants, with a special focus on Brazil and Latin America. She's been involved with former political analyst with the CIA, former foreign policy analyst and advisor with the government, and been on the Council on Foreign Relations, National Task Force on Brazil. I could go on and on, Tanisha, but really people want to hear from you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Kerry. It's my pleasure to join you this morning.
Hey, so Trump's immigration agenda. Tell us what you think.
Well, immigration is once again in the crosshairs of policy debate. The Trump administration has outlined immigration reform as the cornerstone of the administration's broader agenda to reboot America's standing. And you mentioned in the opening divergent views. And boy, oh boy, is this an issue that is really emblematic of that. Immigration, like health care and possibly tax reform, is one of the most complicated and knotty policy issues any administration could tackle. And this administration, true to form, has done so, evoking a tremendous amount of political noise. So in essence, Trump has put forth an immigration overhaul. And as I said, and the word of today is going to be complicated because for your audience, it really is, but we'll try to break it down in the most simplistic form. There are two aspects of this immigration overhaul. The first is about attempting to safeguard American borders, so improving America's homeland security position. And that was reflected in the executive order, travel ban executive order, that Trump issued in January. Your audience might remember there was a lot of political backlash around this. It actually was met with a tremendous amount of legal opposition. And so the Trump administration revoked that initial travel ban and went back to the drawing board and reissued a second iteration of the travel ban, which was set to take effect March 16th. That, too, was met with legal opposition. And in fact, there was a legal injunction. And so it was, quite frankly, dead upon arrival. And what did that travel ban include? It was an outline to bar admission of immigrants from six Muslim-majority countries. And again, the president saw this as a way to safeguard the nation against a possible terrorist attack at the hands of radicalized Islamists. And so there's a ban for Muslims from all six of these countries. It was also a halt on refugee flow for an extended period of time. And the idea behind that was that there's concern because of particularly the case in Syria, it's difficult to determine who's who. And as a way to improve maybe our vetting process, we should just bar all refugees until we can figure out whether people are coming here with legitimate humanitarian concerns or other nefarious purposes. And as I mentioned, this second iteration of the travel ban was met with legal opposition. And so right now it's halted. It's being battled in the court. And the appeal process, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is reviewing this, as is the 4th Circuit Court of Appeals. And so this is going to be bogged down for some time. At this present moment, it's unclear whether the Trump administration is going back to the drawing board for the third time to issue another iteration of the travel ban executive order. This is, again, a cornerstone of his administration, but this has been one of many setbacks that the administration has faced on some of the big campaign policy pronouncements and promises. And so one thing we are sure about with the Trump administration is a degree of unpredictability. So right now we're not sure. What we do know is that it is working through the courts and it will be a lengthy appeal process, something that could actually go to the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that all ties in with the Supreme Court confirmation fight that's shaping up, which will probably be over in the next couple of days in all likelihood. So the travel ban, though, was temporary, correct? 90 days till they got enhanced vetting procedures in place?
For the ban on individuals coming from the identified Muslim majority countries, that was permanent. And for 120 days on banning other refugees from other countries. And so the debate with the travel ban is the constitutionality of it and whether or not the intent and effect of the proposed travel ban is tantamount to a Muslim ban, which would then be identifying persons based upon their religious affiliation and would be unconstitutional by our laws. So the first question is the constitutionality of it. The second question is the policy merit. And if I'm to put on my old policy analyst hat, you know, does this proposal achieve the stated aims? And that's really questionable, Kerry. Identifying states to combat a stateless border is problematic. We're no longer fighting the former Soviet Union where you can identify countries that are antithetical to U.S. interests. We're talking about individuals or groups of individuals who may be inspired by and may not even be directly a part of the larger organizational structure of terrorist groups, but have been radicalized and then carry out these heinous acts. Regrettably, we saw this happen in London just 2 weeks ago. Possibly that's the case that happened out of St. Petersburg yesterday. It's still new and investigations are still underway, so it's not conclusive who was behind the attack on the subway station in St. Petersburg. We saw that even here in the United States with the tragedy of San Bernardino. Now, those were two individuals who were inspired by radical Islamic propaganda and carried out those attacks.
Mm-hmm. Well, how you go about stopping it, I mean, through immigration, not sure about that. Certainly taking in, we've seen what's happened in Europe with a mass flow from purportedly from Syria, but it's really from a number of countries, the refugees in Germany, in Belgium, in the UK, in France. We've got these no-go zones all over the place in France, in Paris, where the police don't go, in Sweden. I mean, the police just won't go there. And, you know, it's really undermining these countries, alienating the populations. So as far as the refugee flow goes, you know, I think the courts are totally off base here. I think whether the policy is ill-conceived or not, I don't think the court, from a legalistic standpoint, and I was a lawyer in a former life, that they've got the right to intercede in this. It's been done numerous times before by many other presidents. Jimmy Carter did it, shut off the flow of entrance from Iran. It's been done so many times before that I think they're totally off base, and I think eventually Trump will be vindicated by the Supreme Court, but I just don't see it as being effective in the final analysis. So the two different stories. Legally, he's probably okay, but in the real world, it's just probably not going to work. So what do you do? How do you stop it is the question. And, you know, I don't think the battle for the hearts and minds is going to work, is working, or will ever work.
It's definitely a challenge, and Europe is on the front lines of this. We've seen the largest migratory flows into Europe since World War II, and it is creating a lot of social and economic pressure for countries that were still crippled after the 2008 economic downturn. And we're not likely to see the same volume of flows just by virtue of geography here in the United States. But that doesn't mean it's something we need to ignore. It's something that we have to work to safeguard our borders much, much better. And so this question of public safety, we're talking about possible immigration flows coming from Muslim-majority countries, coming from countries that are war-torn countries, which, as you mentioned, Syria, but there are a few others. We're also concerned about border safety and public safety concerns of the immigration flow from the southern border. Yeah. So coming out of Latin America, coming from Mexico and Central America. President Trump has made a great deal about attempting to safeguard America. The least, and this is, should be a priority for any administration. I think under the Obama administration, we saw efforts about deporting individuals with criminal records. And so you're absolutely right in mentioning that there were prior presidents who have done so. I think it was really what set it off for Trump with some of the bombastic language that was used during the campaign. I guess he was sort of half jokingly referring to bad hombres, the notion that all Mexicans are criminals. That sort of clouded the discourse. And unfortunately, we somewhat got stuck at that point and have not been able to move through. But this might be a serious issue. Yeah. And how do we do better at improving it? Because, listen, any country that, as you mentioned that you're a lawyer, you know, any country of that adheres to laws has no moral or political obligation to invite or to tolerate individuals, least of all, who are not citizens, who are not going to adhere to the laws of the land, right? Yeah. So this is something that should be universal. This should not be part of the debate. But again, the very, you know, bombastic discourse just set a certain tone for how we address these issues. So in terms of remedies, we are talking about enhanced border security. We are talking about improved vetting system, modernizing the system, making sure that, you know, point A is communicating with point B. This is something that has to be implemented nationally, but also locally in different jurisdictions and different contexts. And so it's not an easy issue, and one that certainly can require additional funding and training.
Yeah, great point. And yeah, it's when you see people coming to this country to take advantage of the social safety network, I mean, the country just can't afford it, especially after the last financial collapse and the deficits we're running. And one of Trump's proposals, and I don't know if it actually has seen a policy initiative, is, hey, if you're here illegally and you're collecting welfare or food stamps or whatever, hey, maybe we don't really want you here because you're not contributing. I mean, I believe that the bulk of or many of the illegal immigrants who are here are really here to work and contribute. And I think they should have a legal means of doing so. I think the immigration system is really ridiculous. But on the other hand, if they're coming to sponge, I mean, I don't think Americans really want to put up with that.
This is where, again, it gets naughty, right? So you're wading into the economics behind the immigration. And to be frank, you know, employers want cheap labor. And employers benefit tremendously from legal and illegal immigration, right? So we have to address it in that side.
Absolutely.
The other side of it is consumers. American consumers want low-priced goods and services. And, you know, we have a very consumer-based culture that has evolved. Americans don't buy things on credit anymore, right? Waiting until you can save enough cash to buy that desired product. We want things pretty quickly, and we want them, again, at reasonable prices, even if you're shopping at Walmart. We want good prices. And so what are the trade-offs for that? And what are we willing to address about this on the table? The estimates are that we have about 11 million undocumented workers here in this country. Again, the figures are probably higher, but roughly in that ballpark. And it's not by coincidence that the highest concentration of immigrants can be found in the six states, which taken together account for roughly 40% of all the goods and services in this country, right? So it's serving some type of economic imperative. Now we're talking about California, Texas, Florida, New York, New Jersey, and Illinois. And these undocumented workers have filled in the gap, low-wage jobs in agriculture. We're talking about maintenance and farm work, leisure and hospitality, construction, landscaping. You know, I think of my hometown. I was reared in Long Island, a quintessential suburban town in Long Island, New York. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I was coming of age decades ago, every Saturday morning, you could awaken to the sound of lawnmowers, usually the adolescent boys, you know, going around the neighborhood earning extra money, you know, mowing the neighbor's lawn. Well, fast forward to 2017, you see none of that. We see trucks of, quite frankly, Latino-owned landscaping companies. I don't even think most of my neighbors own a lawnmower anymore. And so those type of changes, are we prepared to going back to those type of jobs? Perhaps. But the other question is, and the key part of it, low wage jobs. Those jobs do not lead to middle class lifestyle. Those jobs will not support a middle class lifestyle. That doesn't mean that they shouldn't be available for Americans. I'm not making that argument. But it is to say this notion that the middle class will somehow be restored by once again engaging in lawn mowing. Well, not so much. Not today.
The one area, well, and the paper route is another place, another thing that was subsumed by illegal immigration or immigration. Used to be the kid on the bicycle. Now you see generally a Hispanic woman or guy riding around in the morning throwing out the paper. But one thing I would tell you here is in South Florida, where I live, the construction projects used to be all pretty much African Americans, masons, and predominantly the construction projects. Now it's all Hispanic. Now that's a case where you see where they've been displaced. And I'm sure that a lot of the workers are illegal or semi-legal. I don't know exactly how they do it, but that's a case where middle-class workers been displaced and effectively shut out of the middle class.
You can see that too in the hospitality services as well. And that's quite prevalent. And so what makes this difficult is that we're seeing the immigration flows into really lower income, maybe just barely on the rung of middle class communities. And so it's creating economic dislocations. And it's also putting a lot of pressure, you mentioned this earlier, on state resources. So education, we're often going into communities where the school system was already largely in disrepair, right? And so now we have inflows of immigrants and children for whom English is not their first language. And so again, this is putting additional strain and pressure on already taxed educational structures and weakened educational structures. And so this is where it becomes issues we have to work through. Immigration policy requires making choices, right? And it also requires imposing criteria and establishing procedures. And we as a country need to go back and revisit some of the policies and procedures that had been in place. And perhaps they served in our needs for a particular time, but perhaps we're past that. And so, you know, if illegal immigrants serve a certain function in the workforce, maybe there should be an effort to moving towards granting residence or employment permits, a sort of renewable work permit without the promise of citizenship, right? So creating ostensibly an expatriate workforce without the promise of citizenship and without the benefits of citizenship. So again, you mentioned, you know, tax dollars, whether that's welfare, whether that's education or healthcare, et cetera. That's something that needs to be debated, as well as offering, as always, the process towards eventual citizenship for those who desire to become American citizens and all the vetting and all that that entails as a system. Another really problematic and contentious issue is this question about birthright citizenship. We are the only major country in the world to confer citizenship on everybody who was born here. You know, even if your parents are here illegally, there were historic reasons as to why that policy was necessitated. Have we exhausted that? What are the consequences of that? What would it look like if we altered that? These are the real issues that we need to get to. Once we get past the president's tweet and maybe some of his off-putting language, there's some real issues around immigration that need to be discussed in order for us to maintain our competitiveness going forward as a country.
Yeah, I agree. Inflammatory and perhaps bombastic about it these issues weren't even getting addressed by the establishment on both sides of the aisle. Because on the one hand, I think for the Democratic side, it was power base and voters. And on the Republican side, it's their constituency is the beneficiary of the cheap labor and globalist interests. So I think that there was a kind of conspiracy there of silence. So however Trump brought it to the forefront, you know, however inartfully he did bring it to the forefront, and it was a simmering issue and needed to be addressed. So, and then we have the other aspect of the crime associated with it on the southern border. You know, 95% of the felony murder warrants in LA County are for, illegal immigrants, drug gangs, all these things that come with the flow and the exploitation of these people coming over the border, which, you know, is just disgusting. It's in so many different levels, the exploitation. It's got to be stopped. And he's been addressing that too, although perhaps not as publicly, but he really did. I think not the most articulate person. I think he meant to state it one way and it came out another, but these people really do get abused by these mules who take them over the border. And just to reform the policy to stop that in itself, so that they can legally come over and not be exploited, would be a major advance for human rights.
It's a critical issue, and there have been several attempts. I mean, the last effort, the Comprehensive Immigration Reform Act of 2017, didn't really see much daylight. As you mentioned, there are a lot of competing interests, and it sort of just gets sort of tripped over each other, and we're not able to really focus on some of the larger issues that we tried to talk about this morning, about what it really means and what you really have to start thinking through to embark on immigration reform. It's going to require a tremendous amount of leadership and cooperation within the Republican Party to put together something that is cohesive and comprehensive moving ahead. And there's also the foreign policy angle to this as well, because as long as, and now we're just limiting to the flows in from our southern border, as long as we have the difficult, complex situations occurring in country, in Central America in particular, you're going to have this outflow of people. So we have to rethink what our U.S. foreign policy engagement is with these countries, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, in ways that the United States can work bilaterally and also multilaterally to help these countries begin to fix the really disastrous political and economic situation they find themselves in. It's pretty desperate times when you find alarmingly large numbers of unaccompanied minors, children under the age of 12, some as young as 5, 6, 7 years old, traveling by themselves from Honduras to the United States. That must be a pretty abysmal situation that these countries are mired in. And so when we look at State Department cuts, again, State Department as our, principal organ of American diplomacy and efforts around development assistance, et cetera, this is really paramount. So it has to be a multi-variegated approach. Working multilaterally is not something the United States should take on by itself to fix. Obviously, the onus of repairing these countries falls upon those in country. However, the degree to which we can also put that on the table, because otherwise you're going to continuously see people coming. They're not going to stop. And it's sort of the human nature to survive and, try to find a way for their children, if not themselves, to live a better life. And so that has to be on the table as well.
Yeah, I think correct. A lot of these issues really got to be addressed. We can't solve the world's problems, and we have enough problems trying to solve our own. So what about the concept of the wall, which is probably the most controversial and divisive? Supposedly, I heard a claim yesterday, illegal immigration over the border is down close to 70% in the past 3 months since Trump became president. I don't know if I believe it or not, but the concept of the wall, walls traditionally, the Great Wall of China, that was supposed to keep people out, didn't work too well. And that was probably the greatest wall of all time. What is this wall going to do for us here?
Well, the first question is, who's going to pay for the wall?
Well, we know the answer, at least from the campaign trail.
Well, from the campaign trail, and we saw a lot of, you know, the campaigning is one thing, governing is quite another.
Yes.
And so from my lens, the first question of the financials of this, is, you know, that's an enormous undertaking, and who's going to foot the bill? It doesn't appear that the Mexicans are budging, and whether or not this is an effort the United States is going to find resources to do is questionable. Will a border stop the flow of immigration? Questionable, right? Again, as we talked about, people, individuals living in such desperate conditions in countries that are engulfed with violence and political uncertainty. If you are willing to allow your child to travel unaccompanied in a group of other children, I don't know that a wall is going to halt that indefinitely. Again, I think it makes a splash, but I don't think it addresses some of the things we're talking about. You know, the economics of it. What type of citizen structure should we have? Should we create an expatriate workforce? Does birthright citizenship make sense anymore? If we are looking at a mass deportation, what does that mean for the affected industries? What are the humanitarian aspects of that, about repatriating individuals, knowingly repatriating individuals to war-torn countries? These are the things I think that make more sense to think through and spend time on rather than erecting a symbolic wall.
Yeah, for sure.
We don't know who's going to pay for it.
Yeah, that's true. Hey, and, you know, I think, the wall might help stop the flow of drugs to some extent. You know, the flow of drugs is enormous. There are a lot of factors, and we're not going to get to them all today, but it's interesting to know. And I think the mass deportations come down to more getting rid of the criminals element, which there's several million, immigrant criminals in the country, you know, by some accounts, 2-3 million. I think that's what it's been refined down to, from my understanding. It's not clear yet, but it looks like that's what they're focusing on. They got their hands full with that situation. So I guess the policy will start to clarify over the next few months, because you can't do everything. And I think that the idea of getting rid of 11 million people, just not going to happen. I mean, the people who would want it to happen, I think they're coming to the realization as well. It's just not going to happen. So we have to deal with the people who are here and balance the interests of the various parties.
I would agree with that.
So, and the ones who are the threat to society, those are the ones you want to deal with. And really, they're the priority, I think. So,
and that doesn't differ significantly from what the position of the Obama administration as well. I mean, there were efforts as well to deport those with criminal records. Perhaps didn't make as much news about it as we're seeing in the Trump administration, but that was occurring under President Obama's tenure as well. Again, public safety is a critical issue.
Yeah, it really is. A catch and release program. A lot of convicted felons were just released, and then the refusal of these countries to take these people back after they've finished their sentences, and they're relying upon the United States for a lot, and there was no effort made to force them to take these people back. I think those are areas that can easily be addressed. Anyway, Tanisha, really appreciate you coming on the show. In the meantime, if you got any questions, comments on this interview, others, send me an email, kl@kerrylutz.com. kl@kerrylutz.com. The Twitter feed is @KerryLutz, and the Facebook page is Financial Survival Network. Any way for people to reach out to you, Tanisha?
Yes, I will be having a Global South Analytics website will be up and running in the next few weeks, so they can certainly come and leave any comments or questions they have in continuing this dialogue. It's been a pleasure to join you this morning, Kerry. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, Tanisha, and we will have you on again. Let's stay in touch.
Thank you.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.